Here we are. We are back. We are back. And this is Rock to Recovery Radio. And I am your host, Wes Geer. And we are on KX93.5 FM. Also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. A bunch of great treatment programs for mental health, addiction, all sorts of stuff. If you're looking for a great treatment program, please check out New Vista Behavioral Health. So, got to give you the disclaimer. I'm here on the board by myself. Anything that goes wrong, that's what's going on. It's me on the knobs and the brain and the late night and the radio and the thinking and the talking and all these things. But let me get into the show. Why are we here? By the way, I was on a little vacation. I don't know if anybody noticed out there. So we were playing some pre-records. Got the amazing experience of going to Bali. I hadn't been there in 10 years. And it was just, it was a dream. Let me tell you. So why are we here? This is a show about recovery. This is a show about sharing stories, sharing experiences. We interview rock stars, some celebrities, some gurus, all sorts of rad humans that share their story about recovery and not just not dying or just getting sober or just beating trauma, but how they did it and how they got into the vortex of radness. So many people out there are dying, family members and friends and brothers and sisters and mental health and suicide and addiction and overdoses and opiates. It's just a bum out. And when we die, it seems like we're going it alone. But we don't have to go it alone. We have each other. We have experience now. We're talking about this stuff openly. We're bringing it into the public forum. It's no more hiding the fact that Grandpa Louie drinks like a pig every night. We talk about Grandpa Louie. We talk about Aunt Betty. We talk about little Jimmy and the problems that are killing us. Today in the studio, I'm very excited for this guest. I'm very excited. This person is a friend of mine. She's on our Rock to Recovery board of directors. She is a PhD. She is a rad author. She's many things. She's somebody who's overcome trauma on her own. She's sober, brilliant, loving. I mean, you could tell I obviously have a dear affinity for my guest. I mean, you're just an all-around amazing human. I want to introduce my dear friend, Dr. Constance Scharf. Hey, how you doing?
I'm great this evening.
There she is. Hi, world. Dr. Constance Scharf.
Yes.
Who I may refer to as Connie. Would you be mad in the radio?
No, that's totally fine.
All right. Thank you for coming to Laguna Beach.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and what the listeners at home do not know is that you live in Bellevue.
Blaine.
Dang, I always get that wrong. Blaine, Washington.
Yes.
Which is dang near Canada.
It is the border crossing to Vancouver.
Yeah. And so, just to make a finer point of it, like you had to get in a flight and a flight. Well, you got up at 5 in the morning yesterday.
And missed a flight, yeah.
So, I mean, thank you for enduring the travel frustrations to come here and share with us.
I'm thrilled to be here.
And we are thrilled to have you. Totally. So let's get right into it.
Okay.
All right. Do you want to give a shout out to anybody out there? We've never done shout outs on this show, but I suppose we could. Shout out to our homie Phil, if you didn't fall asleep, huh?
Yeah, Phil's listening in Nashville and all the Rock to Recovery guys here in California.
That's right, baby. That's right. So let's get into it. You are a big, you're a supporter of the show, and I know you listen, and it means a lot to me. So you know what's coming. For you, where does it start? Because we always talk about that starting point of the story. Sometimes people want to tie in their childhood. Some people don't. I mean, I already know the answer. For you, it starts as a young girl, doesn't it?
Yeah, it starts for me as a child. You know, I never was really connected with my parents in a positive way. And when I was 6, not quite 7, I was raped and nearly murdered. And
wait a second.
Yeah.
I didn't know the nearly murdered part. You left that out of the story I read.
Yeah. So, well, not everything is in that chapter. So I went home. I didn't know what had happened. And I didn't, even if I had been close with my parents, I didn't know how to tell them. I mean, what do you say if you don't, if you're that young, you don't have words to describe what's gone on.
Was the rape and the murder the same incident?
It was the same incident, yeah.
And who did the raping?
It was at a public pool. It was actually a guy in a gang. And
at 7 years old.
I was not quite seven.
Not quite seven.
Yeah. And so I went home and I didn't know what to do with that. I didn't know how to get support for that. And what I did was I basically just stayed near my father because he was big and he was mean. And I thought, wow, this is protection. And a month later, he started abusing me as well.
Wow. It's like running behind the castle walls for safety and then your own...
Finding out there's been a coup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trojan horse. That is insane. And do you want to talk about his abuse at all? Do you want to name it?
Sure. So it was incest. I mean, he raped me. And it was...
One time?
You know, I don't have much memory of that whole period of my life. But I remember the first time. And what happened in that first time was I dissociated, right? My consciousness left my body because he was so much bigger than me. He was at least between 300 and 350 pounds. And I don't know how much a seven-year-old kid weighs, but I was a scrawny little kid. Mm. And I couldn't breathe. And I was dying, actually. And so I learned not to be present. And I think that really... I don't think that's the cause of my alcoholism, but sure. I think it fueled that alcoholism.
It's part of your story at the least.
At the very least.
Yeah.
So, but what I learned was it's not okay to be present.
For any life or just for the tough stuff?
You know, really for any life. Like it's been a real process for me to learn how to show up and to be in the same room consciously with another human being.
And not to jump ahead too much. You don't get that sense today. And we'll get into that process because you are like, you're there. You're present now. So this is a testament to the work you can do.
Yeah. No, it really is. And so, you know, I knew nowhere was safe. I didn't have anyone to turn to. And so by the time I was 8, I was trying to kill myself.
What were you trying to do?
Well, we lived on a hog farm, which is nice for a nice Jewish girl like me. But we had a grain silo where we kept the food for the pigs.
Yeah.
And I would climb up to the top of the grain silo, and I would look down and wonder if I jumped, was it enough to kill me, or would I just break my legs and back?
Yeah.
And the reason I didn't, I actually wrote about this in my poetry book, the reason I didn't is our farm manager came up. And he saw me. He's like, what are you doing up there? You know, I was like 3 stories high or something.
Yeah.
And I couldn't jump in front of him because I knew he loved me and I couldn't kill myself in front of him.
That is often the thing that keeps us, right?
Absolutely.
That love. I've had suicidal ideation where your brain's like, the pain's so much. Okay, you should take yourself out. And I'm not saying I was close to, quote, pulling the trigger.
Right,
or not,
right.
Right. But it was like, I know my mom loves me. I know my dad loves me. I know my friends. It comes rushing in.
It does. It does. And I was at a point in my life where I could feel that. You know, there were other points in my life where I couldn't. But at that point, I could. Mm. And so, you know, that continued until my parents split. And my mother actually left me at the house with my father. She took my brother and went to her mother's house.
So what does that mean? There's a fight, the marriage isn't going well, and she bails, it's the last time kind of thing?
Well, yeah, he actually beat her, and he had not done that before.
Oh.
And he beat her very seriously. Oh. And she left and took my little brother, but she left me at the house. And then 6 months later, she then came back and picked me up and took me away with her.
So when she leaves you, are you kind of like when your friends are getting in a car and you're like, oh, they know I'm walking up to get in the car now, and the car takes off and you're like, what, hello? Like, was it like that kind of feeling? Like,
I was devastated.
How am I not with you?
Absolutely.
Right.
And I asked her, and she, you know, she said that.
When?
the day after she left, she came back to get, you know, clothes and things from the house.
And you're thinking, oh, now she's going to get me.
She's going to take me too. And she said it was too difficult to take my brother and I to school and get to work. And she was going to leave me at the house.
So it's logistics.
That's what she said. What it felt like, and that may be true.
Might be true.
You know, what it felt like, though, was that she was abandoning me to him.
And I think that's important we talk about that, because I talked about this kind of stuff just in philosophical terms with a friend who said, well, I shouldn't be hurt by that. Right. Let's just say your mom is insensitive at least or whatever. And legit, that was her reasons. I just can't give you a ride. That doesn't matter. If that's how you felt, that is the emotional trauma you have to deal with. So I'm bringing this up for the people at home.
Right. Because I really felt like she knew what was going on. And so I felt like she was sacrificing me to gain her own freedom.
Right.
You know, and I was 10 at the time. And what happened, I was very fortunate. My father had a quote-unquote girlfriend. She was a prostitute. So girlfriend I use loosely. But it's one of the few things I remember about the abuse. She came to the house in the morning and saw me washing my sheets before school. And she thought, 10-year-old kids don't do this. And she immediately figured out what was going on, and she looked me right in the eye, and she said, he'll never touch you again.
Whoa.
So my story is, I find it interesting that the hero in the story is a junkie prostitute who's probably no longer alive.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like a movie script, right, where this seemingly unlikely hero comes in, does something, and then boom, they're gone.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, she was my favorite. She used to use her food stamps to buy candy for me and let me stay home from school and watch General Hospital.
I mean, well, I didn't know that kids like General Hospital, but candy for sure.
Well, yeah, you know, Reese's Pieces are the bomb.
Well, I mean, how... She just put it together. Was there stains on the sheet? I mean, I'm not trying to get too graphic.
Well, no, they were soiled. They were soiled. And so she was a pro. Like,
yeah, she knew.
She knew what was going on. But yeah. I'll tell you, he never touched me again after that.
So how long did this go on?
Three years.
So I don't know where we get the love message that I think we're ingrained with when we come out of the womb. Like, this is my mommy. This is my daddy. They love me. I'm safe here. But that was shattered.
I never had that with my mother. We just never had that bond. And then with my father, it was gone.
Right. So that then you're a child where you must have internal conflict is such an understatement.
Beyond an understatement.
Yeah. So how's life from, you said it was a few years, so 10, 11, how's life go when you're with dad after that?
So my mother and father divorced, and I moved with my mother and her new husband up to Oregon.
Were you happy to go back with mom?
No, I actually wanted to stay with my dad, but I wanted to stay with my brother more. I thought it would be wrong to split us up, so I went to Oregon.
Plus, didn't he feel safer and closer than the parents, maybe?
Well, he'd stopped abusing me at that point.
Your brother?
Oh, my father.
I was talking about your brother, because sometimes that sibling connection is like, because you're young together.
Yeah, I felt
you're
like...
You're in the same environment to some degree.
Yeah, I felt like I needed to protect him, which actually isn't accurate. I was very mean to him as a kid, you know.
Why do you think that was?
That manure rolls downhill.
Right.
You know, I'll clean it up for radio. But yeah.
I get it. Poop rolls downhill.
You know, it's like dad kicks mom, mom kicks the kid, kicks the dog.
You're angry and hurt. You placed it on him.
Yeah.
He was younger?
He's younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you went back with mom's.
I went with mom to Oregon, and I started drinking when I was 11 years old.
That's young.
Yeah. I was out at the barn at a farm. I was out at the barn, and I don't know what happened, but I walked into the house. I poured about a shot from every bottle that she had. My mother is not a drinker, but we had a little bit of liquor in the house for guests or whatever.
My parents did, too. Similar first drink.
Yeah. And I filled up, you know, a highball glass, and I stood over the sink with that disgusting concoction, and I drank it down. and I was immediately drunk.
Yeah.
And I went back out to the barn and laid in the hay, and I thought, this is the best thing that has ever happened to me.
Checking out. Yeah.
Drinking
for effect.
For effect. And it helped me to get to that dissociated state without, without any effort. Because I didn't want to be present. I just couldn't do it.
I don't know why when you're talking about the disassociated state, it reminds me of these faint memories of the couple times I've had physical trauma, like riding my bike in the back of a car, where you just kind of let yourself check out because you don't want to be present, the pain, and I get that.
It's a
weird place we go, isn't it? So you had your first drink. Did you seek it quickly after that? When was the next time you drank?
Yeah, well, I drank because, I'm a little older. I'm 46. And back in the day, you couldn't get heroin in the country. I mean, now, in any
world. But you didn't know about heroin.
Oh, absolutely. My father's girlfriend, the one who saved me, was
junkie. You knew even then it was heroin.
I knew what heroin was, and I wanted to be on the needle. But you couldn't
get
it.
Oh, you consciously knew that.
At 11 years old, I wanted to be on the needle.
I hate to use this word, it's almost intuitive. Because you really don't know, but you know what I mean?
Oh, no, it was intuitive, absolutely. I just knew that that was going to take me to a place I wanted to go. And I really believe that if heroin had been readily available then, like it is now, I'd be dead.
Sure.
I'd be dead. But because I lived in the country, I couldn't get hold of liquor very easily. It was a 30-minute drive into town, and then it's Oregon and had state-run liquor stores, and you can't, it's very hard. But when I got to college, day one, I started drinking almost every day. Because college has this magic thing. They have 21-year-old people there.
Who are proponents of you getting drunk.
Exactly. They're like, hey, I'm like, I'll buy two bottles. Yeah. You want a party? And they're like, absolutely. I started drinking.
You were hey dude-ing it. By Brando's.
Brando says, yeah. So, except we didn't have to sit out in front of a 7-Eleven.
Mm-hmm.
But I had people who could buy for me, and that was magic. And I drank like a fish all through college.
Every day?
Almost every day.
Waking up and drinking?
Not till I got out of college, no. Yeah. But I went to finals drunk. I went to class drunk. I was absolutely just shattered every weekend. I used to sit, when I got old enough to go to bars, I used to sit at the bar and I would hold my index finger out in front of me on my left hand, and I would feel it with my right hand. And when it felt like wood, that's where I wanted to be.
Mm.
Now, I kept drinking past that point, right? Like,
oh, you don't stop.
No, you don't stop.
No,
that's amateurs, right? But you keep going. But that's what I was looking for. I wanted to not feel anything.
Same. Yeah. I talk about it. When I drank, the part when I was happy was when I was lying on my bed where I should be passed out and a human would be passed out. But I'm not. And I'm smoking a cigarette and I'm just kind of staying awake because I like that spot. And I'm dropping the cigarette, burning myself. And I'm like, yeah, this is where I want to be. Almost passed out, obliterated. I get it. And I had those similar situations on tour or whatever, being at the bar and being wasted, can't even stand up, but feeling so alone and going, well, I know I'm drunk and take another shot. Probably won't do much to me. Give me another.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
That's what we do.
Oh, it's totally what we do. I mean, I remember, I worked for a few years in promotion at a couple of record labels. And I remember being at the Troubadour and basically just taking over the bathroom, being like, I'm not leaving here. Like, right. I'm working the show. Like, I'm supposed to be out there with the band doing the thing with the radio
guys.
What
were you doing in the bathroom?
Peeing, throwing up, all the things we do. But I was like, I'm not going to be able to show up for the rest of it.
This is my home.
This is it. Ladies, use the men's room.
All right. So, heavy stuff. We're here with PhD, a.k.a. Dr. Constance Scharf, also known as Ahuva.
Ahuva Bhatia. It's my Bhatia. Hebrew name.
Yes, your Hebrew name, Ahuva Bhatia, writer, award-winning poetry writer, and addiction expert. Man, you help so many people, even people that I'm trying to help. Like, hey, Constance, what should I do with this guy? He's really depressed. You helped me a lot. You're amazing. She's telling her story of sexual trauma from her own father. Just horrible family life and a life of, you made it into college somehow, which is a miracle.
Oh, I graduated in 4 honor societies, Latin honors, the whole thing.
See, this is what I love. And the point I love to say is, like, you can't judge your outside successes to prove that you don't have a fatal disease like addiction and even trauma.
Absolutely.
That you got to process. So we are here with Dr. Constance Scharf. And now I want to go to your first song, which is Running to Stand Still. Oh, that's U2 also.
Yes.
Oh.
U2, I love that band. I always have since I was a kid. And I used to actually, when I would feel suicidal very often, I wouldn't kill myself knowing that they were putting out another album. I was waiting for that new album to drop.
You hear that, Bono? Another life you've saved. I know dudes and bands hear it all the time, but here's another life that was saved by the boys in U2. All right, now let's see if I can hit the buttons and get it to go right. This is Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, and this is U2, Running to Stand Still. Hey, I did it. We'll be right back.
Ooh.
What a beautiful song. That is a beautiful song. I didn't know that U2 song. I'm just going to be honest. I didn't know it.
I love it because it's a song about, you know, substance abuse.
What part of it do you love? What's a lyric or something? Or what's a part of it that moves you so much?
Well, of course, Bono's falsetto, you know.
you said when we were off air that Bono's, there's nothing more beautiful than Bono's falsetto.
But, you know, also, I mean, in terms of the lyrics, you know, that the end result of addiction is death. I mean, we say jails and institutions, but that's, you know, that's just a way station.
It keeps you out of death.
Maybe. It slows your roll. But death is where you're going.
Yeah, 100%. So we're here on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM station, Human Crafted Radio. I am your host, Wes Gear, and this is Rock to Recovery Radio. And we're here with Dr. Constance Scharf, award-winning poetry writer, addiction specialist. As I said, she's a PhD. She's on the Rock to Recovery Board of Directors. She does great work with us, doing our thing. And she's sharing her story of starting at 7 years old, being sexually abused by her father, her mom not being there for her, giving her a feeling of being abandoned. Her parents split up. But somehow, through all this and disassociating with people and not being present, you started drinking at 11. You're already pondering suicide. But you made it into college, and your drinking's escalating. You're showing up drunk for class. You're showing up drunk for finals. But you still got four
National Honor Societies, Latin Honors.
I'm just like you, except, well, I'm sorry, but in scholastically, I'm just like you, only without all the honor society. So you graduated.
Oh, yeah.
What year, if you want, from where?
I graduated from St. Lawrence University. A shout out to St. Lawrence. I love my alma mater. So St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York.
In Canton, New York. And what did you study there?
Government with minors in Asian studies and African studies.
Very impressive for this super damaged child that you have and addicted.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when I came out of St. Lawrence, I really thought that I knew I was an alcoholic. There was no question about that. I was drinking daily at that point. And
did you care?
Not really, no. I knew I was going to die.
That's how I was.
Yeah, I knew I was going to die, and it wasn't a big deal. And I had studied government because I thought I'd train to go into the Foreign Service. Mm. And then I got to live abroad. I lived in India and in Kenya because of St. Lawrence, and I decided that wasn't what I wanted to do. And
so you went to Africa.
I went to Kenya.
For how long were you in those areas?
I was at a semester in Kenya and a semester in India, and I got a research grant to go to El Salvador.
And you were just drinking there too, same
constantly
way?
Constantly.
So just wasted in Africa.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, through this time showing up to class, and even though you're doing well in school, and now you're in Africa for schooling,
yeah,
for additional school, did anybody ever go, yo, girl, you are drinking way too much. What's your problem?
Oh, everybody knew. Everybody
did they
knew.
Give you, did they hit you up? Like, did they say, hey, chill out, or you got a problem, or...
No.
It's interesting, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting, you know, so young that there was a sense of, I knew a couple of people in recovery, and I think there was a sense of, you know, she'll come to it on her own. I don't know that people knew how sick I was, like physically how sick I was. When I was 22, you know, after college, I didn't think about getting a career because I was dying. I was like, there's no point in trying to build a career because you're going to be dead in a year or two. But my liver and kidneys were swollen and distended, and I barely ate. And
did you come to know of the liver and kidney issues?
Oh, you could see them.
Oh, really?
They were that swollen. Yeah. I mean, it was and sensitive and... You know, I was sick.
And you intuitively knew, like...
Well, and I had by that point, I was drinking in the mornings. I had the DTs.
So you're shaking. You have a drink. Can't eat.
Can't eat anything. Yeah. I remember that Nicolas Cage film.
Yes.
What was it called?
Leaving Las Vegas?
Yes, Leaving Las Vegas, where he's the alcoholic. And I actually watched that film drunk, and I related so much to it. I mean, so much to that character.
I liked it. I was like, I can get with what he's doing. Totally.
Oh, the clinking suitcase, right? The clinking suitcase. Everywhere I traveled, I would go to duty-free, and I filled my – I took my carry-on. You know, this is back in the day when you got more suitcases, right?
Yeah.
But I would fill my carry-on with wine and beer and liquor and everything. And I literally had that clinking suitcase.
Yeah. I just related to this whole, like, screw it, I'm done, I'm just going to drink. That was like a freedom that movie made me connect to. Like, yeah, I could relate to that. And when you said I was going to die, I knew it. I remember a time somebody goes, you're an alcoholic. And I was thinking to myself, well, yeah, I'm not trying to live past 30. I figure I'll probably be done in a few years and being totally okay with it.
Yeah, you know, I had some friends who were basically making gentlemen's bets about how long I would live. And I had one friend who thought I might make it to 28, but the rest of them didn't think I'd make it past 25. I'm already 22 years old at this point.
And I'm not trying to blame shift here, but did any one of them go, yo, we got to, you're going to die. What's up? Can we help you? Or you got to do something. It's funny.
You know, this is almost 25 years ago. So, we didn't talk about it the same way then that we do now. You know, I'm 20 years sober. And so, no, I mean, I think people didn't know what to do. I think they just didn't know how to bring it up or what to say.
Fair enough. I think that's valid. Yeah. It seems so obvious, but yeah, they just didn't know.
No.
They didn't know about the disease and that you can arrest it and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we were talking about you went to Africa. You decided that that wasn't for you.
Yeah.
And so you came back to the States, and now you're drinking heavy. You got DTs. And what's next?
So what happened actually is my father very suddenly died. He had a heart attack.
And how old were you?
I was 22 and a half.
Young, so.
I was very young.
And how old was he?
52.
Was he like an overweight dude?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, he was huge. And he'd had heart attacks before. And
so in a sense, it's a shock. But then again, it wasn't a shock.
It was a shock that he died.
Yeah.
Because literally I had seen him 2 or 3 weeks prior, and it had been just a horrible interaction, and then all of a sudden he was gone. But there was a gift in that, because I was already a huge drinker, but when he died, my drinking escalated, and so now I'm drinking in the morning, I'm drinking on the job, I'm drinking it, and I'm always drunk. And I was about maybe 3 or 4 days after he died, I realized, I was like, you're an alcoholic in a different way than I'd known it before, because I always thought that I drank because of him.
Gotcha.
And when he died,
you're drinking at him, kind of.
Yeah. When he died, I was like, I'm not drinking at him anymore, but it gave me an opportunity to live, because while he was still with us, I was too afraid to get sober. When he died, I had the opportunity to make a different choice. And the reason I had that opportunity also, not only because of his death, was because there was a guy at the place that I worked. I worked at an outdoor school. So drunk, taking kids into the wilderness. That's a great combination.
Whoa. Were you hiding it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I had a six pack of beer in my backpack with my first aid kit.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, why bring beer? At that point, you want to go light. Why don't you get into like some moonshine?
Oh, no, I had flasks in both of my back pockets also.
But... Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
There was liquor everywhere. Oh, no. At one facility that I worked at, there was a cattle grate. And I had beer and liquor hidden underneath the cattle grate in the slats. I had whiskey in my shampoo, one of my shampoo bottles. Mm-hmm. I emptied and I had whiskey in the shampoo bottle.
It still had remnants of shampoo on there. You know it did.
Who cares?
Yeah, I know.
You know. Hey,
but listen, for those of you listening at home, if you're sending your children off with some camp instructor and they're drunk, maybe they had a life like Constance. You might want to not get so mad and understand.
We were very fortunate that nothing bad happened. But one of the guys who worked there didn't drink, and he had been in a 12-step program. And he challenged me. He said, you know, why don't you try to control and enjoy your drinking?
Yeah, how'd you come to learn he was in 12-step? Did he tell you right up front, or did he just give you a little tidbits?
No, he told me straight up. He told me straight up that that I don't drink, and, you know, this is why, that I'm an alcoholic, and I've, you know, done this 12-step program. And I would lose the capacity to speak English, which is interesting because English is my first language, and I could only speak in Spanish. And when I'm drunk, yeah. And so, which I'm not.
I mean, I'm sorry. That's just funny to me.
No, it's ridiculous.
It's like a whole comedy movie. Like, oh, she switched to Spanish. She's drunk again.
No, it's true. It's true. But his girlfriend spoke Spanish. And so evidently, and I don't remember this, but she would tell me that when I would switch to Spanish, I would start asking him for help.
Oh.
I would start asking.
And he's like, no comprending. He didn't understand you?
No.
She
had to translate. She'd be like, oh, she's saying she drinks too much and she doesn't know how to stop. And can you help her? And so,
you're kind of a nutcase.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, come on. Because I'm just trying to imagine if I had met you and I'm like, oh, she's pretty cool. Okay, she's kind of drinking. And then you get drunk and you switch to Spanish. I'm going to be like, hey, you guys check out that Constance chick. Whenever she's wasted, she starts talking Spanish.
It's true.
Cuckoo, cuckoo.
Yeah, no, it's true. But
did you ever realize how wacky that was before? Like, sometimes we get more clarity in time, you know?
Yeah, when I got sober, I was like, wow, how is it that you can't speak your native language when you drink? Like, that's bad. Like, that's really accessing some other part of the brain. Like, I don't know what happened.
It does mess up the speech.
Yeah, you know, he said, you know, to try to slow my drinking down, and he challenged me to only drink a six-pack of beer at night. And, you know, a six-pack of beer lasts me like 10, 15 minutes at most, right? And then what do I do with the rest of the night? And how do I not be sick, you know? And I found out that the longest I could go without alcohol was 6 days. On my own willpower. That's how long I could go.
Now, when he challenged you, were you like, oh, heck, I can never do that, or screw this? Or were you still under the delusion you could control it? Because that's really...
Oh, no, I thought I could. I was like, I'm going to show him. Like, this fool thinks I can't, you know.
Isn't that crazy? And I was the same way. Like, in whatever. I had it with whiskey, but I had it with methamphetamine all day, every day, meth. But somehow I thought I could still control it. And they say... that is what every drinker wants to prove, that they're normal, and the thought that they one day will control it takes them through the gates of insanity or death. That's some literature, right? Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Or junkies, no, I'm only going to do a little bit of dope. I'm only going to shoot a little bit. And we really think we can control it when evidence shows we've never controlled it. When had been the last time?
I never tried to. Like even now when people, you know, say, you know, don't you miss drinking? I'm like, no, because I wanted to be absolutely obliterated.
Annihilated.
I didn't want the flavor. It wasn't like a nice thing on a summer day to have a cold beer. Like I needed a cold beer in the shower to get me back to the refrigerator to get another beer.
Yeah, I get that. And yeah. Wow. Trying to control it. It's insane. So how do you hit bottom?
So he said to me, both of us had ended up moving to Southern California. I lived in LA. He lived down in San Diego. He finally was like, you either need to go to a 12-step program and get sober, or we can't, you know, be friends anymore because it's too much. I mean, I would be so drunk that
You were working together as well. Did you get fired or?
No, it was a temporary job. All those jobs are temporary. And, you know, I would call him from bathrooms at fancy Beverly Hills restaurants. Absolutely lost. I was like, I don't know where I am. I'm in a bathroom somewhere. And he's like, go outside. If you can open the door, which sometimes I couldn't even open the door of the stall. He'd be like, if you can open the door, your family's all sitting out front waiting for you to come out.
Oh,
I mean, I was that
coming out of a blackout.
Yeah. I was like that kind of a drunk. And so he's like, you have to get sober. And he was the only friend I had. He was the only person I knew because I had just moved here.
And you guys related on the alcoholic
level. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so I did. I went to a 12-step meeting. My friend, who's not an alcoholic, took me. We got dressed up. We wore makeup, you know. We showed up late. We didn't know it was a closed meeting, but, you know, she took me anyway. I mean, we just didn't know anything. And we left at the coffee break because we didn't know better. But I went.
Yeah.
I went. And what happened was it took me a little while to get sober, because when I stopped drinking, first of all, I didn't know you could die from.
Can we hit pause really fast? Yeah. Was there like a moment of clarity, like a certain defined moment? No. You just kind of like foggily morphed into, okay, I'll go to a meeting.
Yeah.
Cool.
But what happened was when I stopped drinking, and I didn't know you could die from alcohol detox.
Yep.
And so I detoxed myself, and that was.
Which is important people know
horrifying.
At home. Alcohol detox and benzos are the two that can kill you.
Go to the hospital.
You got to get a medical detox because you can die. And there's people that try to do it all the time.
Yeah.
Very dangerous.
Yeah.
You think coming off of heroin's tough and meth or whatever, it's actually not dangerous at all, right?
No, it's painful.
Painful, but
it's
you don't die from it.
Not usually. But from alcohol, there's a very high chance that seizure and death.
Yeah.
So, but the trauma came up, and I couldn't stay sober with feeling the trauma, and I didn't know how to address it. And it took me.
So you go into AA for how long when you're starting to realize, oh, now that I'm trying not to drink?
Oh, it started pretty much immediately. I mean, I was in 12-step programs on the west side of Los Angeles, and I was known for punching. You know, someone would come up and tap me on the shoulder, and I'd wheel around and knock you on the ground. You know, I mean, you did not talk to me.
In fact, it seemed like you probably have a pretty good punch, too.
Yeah, Sonny always says I pack a wallop. You know, no, I'd knock you on the ground. In fact, I went to women's meetings a lot because you had less chance of being punched.
For the guys,
yeah, 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 you know. And, you know, I ate my way through the very first year, right? I gained 70 pounds the first year. If you want it back, I still have it. I could share that with you. A very good friend of mine in the program, really my mentor, got cancer, and I had relapsed and was not going to 12 steps anymore. And he called me up and he said, I want to see you, but you got to be clean to come to my house, because he had very severe liver cancer. And he's like, I'm going to die soon, and I've got great drugs, and you can't be in my house if you're not clean. And I got sober. And I don't know what happened when he died. He said he wanted to see me get 100 days, and he died when I had 101.
Wow.
And
Did you talk to him on the 100th day?
On the 99th, yeah. I was at his house, and I was complaining about something.
And that's what we do when we're
always, yeah, always. Yeah. I think about traffic, actually. You know, it's L.A. What are you going to complain about traffic?
Yeah.
And he pulled his oxygen mask off, and he said, well, I'm dying. And I said, what do you want? He said, I want to see you get 100 days.
So on 99 days, he said.
It was 98 or 99 days, yeah. Right before he went to the hospital for the last time.
Which is brilliant. It's just like, just make it to the next day or so. Like,
just, yeah.
And that's what we do, right? In recovery, it's just like, just get to tomorrow.
Just
don't worry
get to
about
tomorrow. Yeah. And but since he died, it just, that desire to drink was removed. It was just removed. Like, I couldn't throw my sobriety away after that. You know what I mean? Like,
miracles come in all forms, don't they?
Yeah. And so, And I've been sober now 20 years.
So that was what date that you got sober, I guess?
June 28th, 1998.
1998. Yeah, you took 20.
20 when in New Orleans.
Yeah. You took 20 in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Which is where he was from. So it was super
special.
So,
like,
to be
is it
there.
Odd or is it God? It is crazy.
Exactly.
So let's put in this other song, and then we can come back and talk about. I mean, there's so much we could talk about in your life now, but I think it's important to talk about how you had to address the trauma and the work you do now.
Great.
You know? So the next song, it's another U2 song, and it's named after my current age. 40. I don't know why you're
in
laughing.
In your dreams.
Hey, I know. I'm 38. I can't wait to be 40 someday. So why did you pick this song?
Oh, well, it's another U2 song. And, of course, they sing it at the end of all their concerts. And
is this what they end with?
Usually, yeah.
I did not know that.
It's a big sing-along. Sing this with me. This is 40.
I Oh, I should have had the music right there. Sorry. So, yes, we are. This is Wes Geer, your host on Rock to Recovery Radio, KX93.5 FM. We're here with Dr. Constance Scharf telling us the story how she went through trauma and addiction and somehow miraculously stayed sober. And we'll be right back. This is, which button do I want to hit? F12. This is U240.
I waited patiently for the Lord. He climbed and had my kind. He brought me up out of the depths, out of the mighty clay.
Song. Now, here we are back on KX93.5 FM. This is Rock to Recovery Radio, also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have all sorts of different programs for mental health, for addiction, helping professionals. There's a lot of shady programs out there these days that are in it for the wrong reason. I know these people. I know the program and the work they do, the programs. So if you're looking for a great program, you need some help, check out New Vista Behavioral Health. We're sitting here back from listening to U240 with Dr. Constance Scharf, who's a friend. She's on the Rock to Recovery Board of Directors. So I do have a little bias here, but she's also an award-winning poetry writer. She's written a book called Ending Addiction for Good.
Correct.
You're an addiction specialist.
Researcher, yeah.
Okay, researcher, world traveler.
Yes.
And in the story, for those of you coming in late, she went through sexual trauma from her father, a mom that for every other, just seemed like you felt completely abandoned by her.
Yeah.
Broken home, to say the least. And somehow you made it through college. You started drinking at 11, but you were suicidal before that.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking about jumping off the grain silo.
Off the grain silo. Well, yeah, because there was no solution. I mean, drinking was my solution.
And even though you're drinking to blackout, somehow made it through college, graduated with four whatchamahosets.
Lots of honors, yeah. Lots of honors.
And you went to Africa to work for a while thinking you're going to work overseas. You came back home. You were working at camps.
I worked at summer camps.
With children.
With a six-pack
of beer in the backpack and some hard liquor in flasks.
Two flasks, one in each hip pocket, yeah.
And you had what they call an Eskimo. Because
yes, I had an Eskimo. Andrew A.,
a sober dude who kind of was planting some seeds, challenging you.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also, by the way, it's in the, I can say this, it's in the AA book. It doesn't say how to stop drinking. It says, if you're not sure, try to control your drinking.
That's right.
And that's what he did to you. He pulled a little fast one and said, mm-hmm. hey, see if you can control it.
Mm-hmm.
So many of us think we can. You found out you couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Your friend's dying of cancer.
Marcel M.
Who you started going to 12-step meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to visit him, and he said, hey, just make it to 100 days.
Make it to 100 days.
And somehow, at that point, you lost that obsession to drink.
Yeah.
And you stayed sober ever since, which was
June 28th, 1998.
You just took 20 years.
20 years.
When we, and this is the cool stuff that happens in sober life, weird, coincidental, slash God shot, slash vortex of radness, whatever you want to call it, stuff lines up. So we go to Nashville for the first time with Rock to Recovery ever to present to NAMI.
Oh, New Orleans.
Nollins. What did I say?
Nashville.
Sorry.
We went to Nashville too, but New Orleans.
Nollins. We went there. And we were presenting to NAMI, which stands for?
National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Alliance. That's where I mess up. On mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And you were there with Sonny Mayo,
mm-hmm.
my homie, our homie.
Our homie.
Rock to Recovery, dude, Snot, Seven Dust. We were all together, and we had this special thing that we were all together on your 20th.
On my
20th. Doing this special stuff.
Yeah. We're in Marcel's hometown, my mentor's hometown.
Who's asked you to not.
To just make it to 100 days.
Just make it to 100 days. We actually did a Rock to Recovery music therapy session with
Correct.
A bunch of people suffering from mental illness.
Yes.
And had magic.
Yes.
On that day. It was a beautiful thing.
Well, and that's really my specialty is co-occurring disorders. I was about 10 years sober. I was in graduate school, and the veterans were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. It was actually a little before that. We're coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they weren't staying sober, and they were killing themselves right, left, and center. I mean, we lose so many veterans to suicide. And
they say 22 a day, but that's not accurate. They think it's a lot more.
Yeah, we don't really have good statistics on it, and we don't have good statistics on caregivers of veterans either and their family members who are also killing themselves in, we believe, unprecedented numbers. But, you know, I was miserable because I just didn't have that solution to the trauma. And I thought, these guys didn't serve to live these lives, and I didn't get sober to be miserable. And I changed everything I was doing in graduate school. I got a new dissertation chair, and I started looking for those solutions for trauma and for addiction that you know, we weren't using 10 years ago. And I was very fortunate that a friend of mine who owned a treatment center up in Malibu created a position for me to do addiction research and work on these solutions. And that's what I've been doing with my life ever since. And I'm so fortunate because, you know, I get to try these things out on myself. And, you know, there are therapies available that, like Rock to Recovery music therapies and trauma treatment programs, that really do address the issue in ways that we used to think were not possible. I mean, we really thought that the brain was just wired in a negative way, and that was it. You were just going to suffer with, you know, trauma-related issues. And, you know, recently I've been doing a therapy program with Brandon Parkhurst, mm-hmm. The Radical Aliveness and Core Energetics. And it's just absolutely changed my life. And there are these things out there that change your life. And they're, you know, they're available. And we know about them. That's the beautiful thing about addiction research. We know it's there. And I get to bring that information really to anyone who listens. Like, I love to share that. That's what I love to do.
And I channel a lot of people I'm working with that, because I'm just a guy who knows how to stay sober. I don't know I don't know trauma and, you know, depression and stuff like you do. And you've been a great resource huge. I mean, you know some stuff.
50% of addicts have a dual diagnosis, and so it's really something that we have to address if they're going to have an opportunity to stay sober and live a happy life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it doesn't just mean, sometimes it does, but it doesn't just mean take meds.
No.
What you're talking about, this core energetic stuff, is that this stuff is stored deep down inside, and we got to feel through it and excavate it, if you will. Dig it out, feel it, process it, give it a true voice, and then we start recovering. And what you're talking about in your story is like you got sober and then instantly, oh my gosh, here come all these feelings.
Here come all these feelings, and what do I do with them? And that's why people relapse, and that's why people kill themselves. And we have to address that.
We have to address it. And so a selfish plug here is you and I are working on a book.
I am so thrilled about this project. So my true love in life is to be a writer. I wrote Ending Addiction for Good with Richard Tate back in 2012. And I have Meeting God at Midnight, my poetry book. But you and I are writing Rock to Recovery. And it is a wonderful opportunity for us to share the ways in which music, you know, and the program that you created changes lives, but also the science behind it and how it changes the brain and really makes addiction treatment stick, gives people a chance to process those feelings.
Absolutely. And we get to do it with wounded veterans, you know.
Absolutely.
Who are dealing with tons of trauma, and the transformations you see are remarkable.
Mm.
And we're not trying to be jerks here and just talk about our book, but the reason we're talking about it is because there is hope, there is data, there is things that are working, and we're all just trying to share it, because once you come out the other side, like you, I mean, people at home don't know, I talk to you daily, and I know you're still at 20 years sober.
20 years sober.
Doing the work to exercise those demons that are plaguing you and haunting you, etc., to reach a next level and a next level of happiness, contentment, peace. It's huge.
Well, you know, people with a story like mine, they usually overdose or suicide. Like, you don't see people, you know, go on and get a PhD and work with, you know, veterans and addicts and whatnot. But I mean, there is so much hope. If I can recover, I mean, literally coming from where I come from, if I can recover, anybody can. It really is true.
It really is true. And on that note, I mean, I can't thank you enough. It's a testament, too, to how much you love carrying the message that you flew down here from Washington on a couple flights and 5 a.m. and all that, just to share your story. You know, that's a big deal. And that's what we find that makes us feel really good, doesn't it?
It does.
So if you're at home, I hope you got a little bit of hope and realize that, gosh, there's always a way out. You're never too sick. You're never unworthy. There's always somebody who has it worse than you that's found an answer and made their way out. So the answer is just in opening up and asking for help. And that's all we want you to do. You don't have to suffer alone. We can recover together. So on that note, this has been Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wesley Gear. Brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. Had a great time with you, my dear friend and love, Dr. Constance Scharf. We are out of here.